This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The critical relationship to the Moscow Diary that Eduardo's and Mike's highly suggestive conceptual framework delineates for us today invites us not only to reconsider the philosophical stakes of straying, but also, in turn, to stray ourselves, to stray from ourselves, which is to say to stray among the trajectory that the title of our workshop aptly names the drifts of history. To reflect on Benjamin's text also is to find oneself already adrift in history, among its words and images, and in the experience of a drift that will also cause us to stray from the Moscow Diary, even and especially when we may believe ourselves to be particularly close to it. It is therefore in the spirit of Benjamin's own straying, as well as our common endeavor to reflect on the Moscow Diary in terms of its movement of straying, that I shall also be straying from it, drifting across a variety of related Benjaminian texts, in order, however, to remain faithful to a set of core concerns or question marks that impose themselves on and by means of Benjamin's thought. My wager will be that these movements of straying and drifting enter into a Benjaminian constellation with this preoccupation with another key concept, that of inheriting. Straying, drifting, inheriting. But at this late hour, are we still inheriting Benjamin? Will we ever stop inheriting him? What would it mean to stop inheriting Benjamin? What would it mean to have inherited him in the first place? If I were permitted at the outset of my remarks to stray into a confessional mode, I would say that inheriting Benjamin, for me, is always also a self-inheritance. I was first introduced to Benjamin by an enlightened philosophy teacher in my gymnasium in Cologne, who had a special interest in the early Frankfurt School and the history of philosophy with which it engages. He read Plato, Descartes, Hegel, and others with us. One day in 11th grade, when we had just finished reading To Have or To Be by Erich Fromm and Dialectic of Enlightenment by Horkheimer and Adorno, the philosophy teacher unpacked a stack of yellow, greenish Zurkamp paperbacks, announcing that we would be reading the work of art in the age of its technical reproducibility by someone named Benjamin for the next few weeks. Baffled by the writer's apodictic and refractory way of thinking and writing, yet already sensing a deep affinity for his penetrating and poetic tropes, I began slowly, laboriously, and always I felt altogether incompletely to inherit Benjamin. The Moscow Diary itself embodies another particular genealogy of inheriting for me. It was almost exactly 20 years ago that I worked obsessively on the Moscow Diary here at Princeton, composing adrift somewhere between East Pine and Firestone, a 90-page text whose line-by-line reading of Benjamin's refractory diary eventually became the chapter Benjamin's Body, the Alterity of the Corpus in the Moscow Diary, in my first book, which concerned the relationship among the idiomaticities of Benjamin's rhetorical signature, his autobiographical corpus, and the philosophy of history. It is in this regard that the thinking of Nietzsche, Benjamin's abiding intertext, makes itself felt. Nietzsche speaks of, quote, impossible times when one does not know how old one is or how young one is yet to be, unquote, in a moment of inheritance that is both a radical beginning and a perpetuation of something ancient. If Nietzsche emphasizes the seemingly paradoxical possibility lodged within a certain inheritance that one's youth may still be to come, even late in life, he holds open both the potentiality of a transformation into something new and young, while at the same time considering the ways in which such a belated youth must always be inscribed in the afterness of a life already lived. The inheritance of a lived life that, in fact, makes the possible experience of one's possibly belated youth thinkable in the first place. The experience that unfolds here is adrift among the multiple vectors of a discontinuous time. It strays from, even breaks with the past and must return to that past over and over again in order to come to terms with its own departure, actual or envisioned, from it. If Benjamin writes that what he encounters during his stay in Moscow, that is, quote, those concrete phenomena of daily life which affected me most deeply, unquote, is, quote, even far more incommensurable than I had expected, unquote, not only in relation to his erotic interest, Asia Latsis, but also in relation to his experience of the city and its culture as such, he finds himself adrift among a system of signs that refuses to yield itself to hermeneutic revelation. In Benjamin's letter to Martin Buber of February 23, 1927, composed only 3 weeks after his return from Moscow, as Gershom Scholem reminds us in his commentary to the first edition of the Moscow Diary, Benjamin explains the specific rhetorical mode of his Moscow reflections. As Scholem points out, quote, Benjamin's own assessment of his experiences in Moscow can be very precisely inferred, unquote, from the letter to Buber, even though Scholem himself refrains from offering an interpretation of this assessment. And this is the passage in question. Benjamin writes, quote, my presentation, or Darstellung, a term which has a complex legacy in Benjamin's work, will be devoid of all theory. In this fashion, I hope to succeed in allowing the creatural to speak for itself. Inasmuch as I have succeeded in seizing and rendering this very new and disorienting language that echoes loudly through the resounding mask of an environment that has been completely transformed, I wish to write a description of Moscow at the present moment in which all factuality is already theory, and which would thereby refrain from any deductive abstraction, from any prognostication, and even within certain limits of any from any judgment, unquote. Benjamin here places the bodily, creaturely dimension of his Moscow project into conceptual relation with its theological inflection, partially in response to Hermann Cohen and the Marburg Neo-Kantians. And by inheriting Goethe's phrase in which alles Faktische schon Theorie ist, all factuality is already theory, Benjamin evokes a network of cultural and aesthetic references that had imposed themselves on his thinking at the time, alluding to the privileging of documentary-style literature and art advocated in Soviet Russia by, among others, the editors of Left Front and the surrealist branches of the Soviet constructivists, and in Germany by the aesthetic movement called Neue Sachlichkeit, among others. Yet Benjamin's sentences do not imply that his descriptive account will avoid the theoretical as such. On the contrary, what emerges from the description already is saturated by the theoretical, except that this theoretical dimension is not the product of an intentional author function, a form of sovereign consciousness named, for example, Walter Benjamin. It is necessary for Benjamin's writing to assume this critical position if he wishes to do justice to the experience of receiving a legacy, a particular Russian legacy in this case, which it wishes to inherit but which it cannot comprehend as a transparent given. Just like no act of inheriting the idiomaticity of Moscow could situate Benjamin in a position of mastery, not even a mastery of straying or drifting, no act of inheriting Benjamin's Moscow diary could situate an heir in the position of mere successor. At least not if by successor what is meant is someone who receives a self-identical legacy consisting of transparent and comprehensible precepts that could be implemented at will, say, a systematic account of language, a set of stable political concepts, or a unified philosophy of history. It is no accident that already the young Hegel observes, quote, with regard to the inner essence of philosophy, there are neither predecessors nor successors. So this is a quote from the Differenzschrift. In Rücksicht aufs innere Wesen der Philosophie gibt es weder Vorgänger noch Nachgänger. This is so, in part, because philosophy is the site, according to Hegel's logic, in which reason reflects on itself, an activity in which a core set of concerns is self-reflexively engaged over and over, regardless of the individual thinker who acts as the agent or site of reflection in any particular instance. Yet Hegel's sentiment also problematizes the very notion of intellectual inheritance, rather than assuming that it is self-evident and requires no further consideration. Hegel's apodictic statement should resonate with readers of Benjamin's Moscow Diary. After all, there's nothing at all self-evident about the notion that we should know how to inherit the thinking and writing of Benjamin today. Benjamin's thinking itself is rooted in the conviction that an inheritance is not only mediated by language, but takes place in language. As he writes in a fragment on the mode of inheritance we call translation, quote, "There is no world of thought that is not a world of language, and one only sees in the world what is presupposed by language. Es gibt keine Gedankenwelt, die nicht eine Sprachwelt wäre. Und man sieht nur das an Welt, was durch die Sprache vorausgesetzt ist." This preconditioning by language requires constant attunement to the textual basis of cognition, a perpetual interpretation and reinterpretation of the ways in which language makes the world what it appears to us. It is this abiding engagement with language, both Benjamin's and ours with Benjamin's language, that structures the experience of inheriting his words. It is as though the strange inheritance that Benjamin's often apodictic, melancholy, or refractory thoughts and sentences bequeath upon us are not easy to accommodate into our received intellectual registers, especially today, some three-quarters of a century after his premature death following Nazi persecution. At times, it would seem easier to disown Benjamin's enigmatic inheritance by making him disinherit us, by rejecting a legacy or tradition of thinking that self-consciously refuses to yield the stable insight of a self-identical system of concepts. Perhaps the question for us as heirs of Benjamin is how we can inherit him today by looking at our own predicaments from his vantage point, instead of reducing him to a category, this or that perceived instrumentality, function, or usefulness with respect to other motives. Such a shift in perspective would have nothing to do with uncritical piety or even hagiography. Slavoj Žižek puts it well when he avers that, quote, "When we are dealing with a truly great philosopher, the real question to be raised concerns not what this philosopher may still tell us, what he may still mean to us, but rather the opposite, namely what we are, what our contemporary situation might be in his eyes, how our epoch would appear to his thought," unquote. And this is a rather Benjaminian thought that he pursues there. Benjamin will have a lot to say about precisely this movement in a number of places, including his concept of literary history and so on. Turning the telescope the other way, as it were, opens up possibilities for inheriting that have remained unthought. Inheriting an intellectual legacy, particularly such resistant Benjaminian works as the Moscow Diary, is not a self-evident given, a transaction to be initiated and completed whenever we choose, but rather an open question. As Benjamin writes in the early sketch Trauerspiel and Tragedy, quote, "The time of history is infinite in every direction and unfulfilled at every moment. This means that no single empirical event is thinkable that would stand in a necessary relationship to the particular historical situation in which it was produced," unquote. Far from assuming an ahistoricist perspective vis-a-vis an event, Benjamin wishes to emphasize the ways in which a possible relationship to an event, such as precisely his Moscow journey, becomes a matter of inheriting it, that is, learning to read it and to relate to it in a way that is unforeseeable and that requires acts of interpretation for which the inheriting subject could not have been prepared in advance. In other words, our understanding of the relationship between a textual utterance or other phenomenon in its particular historical situation in 1920s Moscow, as much as in Berlin and Paris, but is also not foreclosed a priori by an alleged necessity, but rather is a matter of learning how to read and interpret in the future, that is, a matter of learning to inherit. This learning how to inherit This opening up to the radically inherited nature of all genuine knowledge traverses in the variety of tonalities Benjamin's corpus as a whole. As early as September 9, 1917, in a letter to Scholem, Benjamin insists that, quote, tradition is the medium in which the person who is learning continually transforms himself into the person who is teaching. Die Tradition ist das Medium, in dem sich kontinuierlich der Lernende in den Lehrenden verwandelt. Benjamin stresses the way in which an intellectual heir who, quote, encompasses the tradition in his own way, makes it communicable by teaching. Knowledge becomes transmittable only for the person who has understood his knowledge as something that has been transmitted. He becomes free in an unprecedented way. Auf seine Weise die Tradition umfasst und lehrend mitteilbar macht. Wer sein Wissen als Überliefertes begriffen hat, in dem allein wird es überlieferbar, er wird in unerhörter Weise frei. There can be no inheriting of a tradition without a perpetual transformation, in which the one who receives, der Lernende, also becomes the one who passes on, der Lehrende. But one cannot have anything to pass on without first having struggled to receive it and to open up to its challenge. The task, as Benjamin tells us, is to grasp that the archive of all knowledge one might believe oneself to possess comes from an elsewhere. That is, this knowledge is an inherited tradition to which one chooses to relate in a singular and unprogrammable way. Indeed, there can be no Überlieferbarkeit of an intellectual tradition, no possibility for a heritage to be transmitted or handed down without first wrestling with the implications of its very status as inheritance and transmission. When Benjamin suggests that a certain experience of freedom suffuses this moment of grasping, begreifen, he qualifies it with the adverb unerhört, speaking of an experience of being in unerhörter Weise frei, being free in an unprecedented, or more literally, an unheard of way. This radical experience of freedom differs from any expected or more familiar notions of freedom in that it is predicated upon an understanding of knowledge as a matter of inherited transmission, Überlieferung, and transmissibility, Überlieferbarkeit. The freedom prompted by this particular knowledge about the transmitted, inherited status of all knowledge unfolds on the level of the uncontainable, the caesura that interrupts expected ways of relating to the concept and the experience of freedom itself. It is no accident that Benjamin uses the word unerhört in this context, because in addition to signifying something unprecedented, it also means scandalous or outrageous. The freedom that attends to the act of inheriting, the act of begreifen, grasping knowledge as a mode of transmission and reception, also always is a matter of scandal and outrage, since it cannot fully conform to established conventions, authorized procedures, or legal norms for the inheritance of a legacy. What is unerhört about the freedom that is at stake here is precisely the ways in which such freedom allows for previously unknown modes of relating to the inherited knowledge or the transmitted legacy. The experience of the heir as the one who both receives and transmits a tradition is marked by a freedom that is conscious of its unfreedom, as it relates and answers to what came before it, and that affirms its own status as freedom precisely by striving to discover how to relate to the tradition in a new and singular way. Nietzsche, without whom Benjamin could not imagine inheriting, in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, explicitly thematizes the always recalcitrant act of inheriting reading in the context of his thinking of genealogy. We find the following remark in the section on the bestowing virtue, also von der schenkenden Tugend. Now Nietzsche says, quote, "Alas, much ignorance and error have become embodied in us. Not only the reason of millennia, their madness too breaks out in us. Auch ihr Wahnsinn bricht an uns aus. It is dangerous to be an heir. Gefährlich ist es, Erbe zu sein." The target of Nietzsche's critique of reason is not merely the way in which certain aberrations from an otherwise triumphant march of reason deserve to be singled out for criticism and correction. On the contrary, Zarathustra's insight is precisely that the inheritance of an intellectual tradition is touched by the ever-present danger of inheriting a certain madness, a wahnsinn, along with it, sometimes even instead of it. This danger can hardly be circumvented by means of the intellectual tools supplied by the inheritance itself. The opposite is the case. The tools themselves may even be the danger. For Nietzsche, the irreducible danger of being an heir is condensed in Zarathustra's consideration of death and even suicide in connection with the inheritance. Whoever has, and this is Nietzsche, whoever has a goal and an heir, wer ein Ziel hat und einen Erben, wants death at the right time for his goal and heir. And out of reverence for his goal and heir, he will no longer hang withered wreaths in the sanctuary of life, unquote. Yet what would be the right time with regard to a targeted goal and a recognized heir? When is the hour of the heir? And what kind of a goal connects the one who departs with the figure of his heir? If it is dangerous to be an heir, as Nietzsche emphasizes, we are placed in the realm of a legacy in which we are constantly called upon to consider these questions anew, for they are forever intertwined with the concept and the experience, Benjamin would call this the Überlieferung, of an intellectual inheritance itself. As Jacques Derrida, a rigorous reader and heir of both Nietzsche and Benjamin, reminds us in his book on Marx, one, quote, never inherits without coming to terms with, or s'expliquer avec, some specter, and therefore with more than one specter, unquote. This perpetual coming to terms is the particular form that a haunting engagement with spectrality, or ghostly conversation with the dead, assumes. The condition of possibility for this spectral engagement with an inheritance is the legacy's resistance to transparency and understandability. Quote, if the readability of a legacy were given, natural, transparent, univocal, Derrida suggests, if it did not call for and at the same time defy interpretation, we would never have anything to inherit in the first place, unquote. Inheriting means inheriting from a secret, that is, from a language that exposes just enough of itself to be recognized as language, but that does not provide the tools with which to make sense of it. Its reading remains necessary, but always also eludes its own closure. To inherit means to interpret. The legacy that is handed down to us can hardly be a matter of appropriation, but rather exposes us to the difficulty of showing ourselves as responsible heirs to something that both beckons and resists us. The outcome of an act of inheriting can never be the assured recuperation of a loss or its sublation into a form of redemption. It may be tempting to take Benjamin's occasional mobilization of the tropes of redemption and recuperation at face value, as is done in some areas of Benjamin's studies. Even a careful, erudite, and redoubtable reader, scholar of Benjamin, such as Stefan Moses, holds this optimistic view. As for Benjamin, he tells us, quote, he proposed the vision of a history in which nothing is sacrificed, nothing is lost forever. If each moment of the past can be reactualized, replayed under the conditions under other conditions on a new stage, nothing in human history is irreparable, unquote. From this perspective, quote, the correction of the errors of the past, unquote, remains a permanent possibility. But such an interpretation ultimately would amount to ascribing a quasi-Hegelian point of view to Benjamin that he does not in fact share. For the Hegelian dialectical system, as memorably outlined in the Phenomenology of Spirit, in the end, nothing really is lost because it can and will be reinscribed in sublated form in the progression of the dialectic itself. Each loss is only a loss for the time being. After all, its sublation and reintegration into the movement of Geist will be its conceptual redemption. While one might argue that there is a certain inability to mourn within the logic of Hegel's system, such is not the case in the world of Benjamin. Even and indeed especially in the act of inheriting, there can be no assured recuperation, no assumed overcoming of sacrifice. Nothing safeguards the conceptual or experiential redemption of Benjamin's drifting through the streets of Moscow, his enigmatic encounters there with Mayakovsky, Bely, and Lilievich, or his upsetting experiences with local journalistic practices, as when an interview he granted to a Moscow daily newspaper is published only in a most disfigured form. Instead, the act of inheriting is intricately bound up with the permanent possibility of absolute failure, radical loss, uncircumventable finitude, and inconsolable mourning, much like Benjamin's experience of Moscow itself, in which, as he writes, nowhere does Moscow look like the city itself. This permanent possibility also accounts for why Benjamin thinks the relation between Erbe and Rettung, so recuperation, rescue, redemption, salvation, as a mode of conceptual labor along the double axis of promise and failure, rather than as a triumphant accomplishment. In the Arcades Project, Benjamin notes, from what are phenomena rescued? Not only, and not in the main, from the disrepute and the disregard into which they have fallen, but from the catastrophe that is presented very often by a certain means of their transmission, Überlieferung, their appreciation as heritage or inheritance. Benjamin's phrase is Würdigung als Erbe. Würdigung als Erbe. They are rescued through the exhibition of the crack, Sprung, within them. There is a transmission that is catastrophe, unquote. If the inheritance of a phenomenon entails learning to relate to an inheritance in a way that is not merely a catastrophic handing down, then the heir must attend to the crack or fissure, Sprung, that traverses what is to be inherited. For Benjamin, a catastrophic form of receiving and transmitting an inheritance occurs when the stability and self-identity of the inheritance is taken for granted, that is, when an heir is deaf to the specific and highly instructive ways in which the phenomenon, entity, or archive to be inherited resists appropriation. To quote-unquote rescue a phenomenon, in the Benjaminian sense, means to inherit it as the irreducible enigma that it is, and to attempt to interpret it always one more time. What remains in this particular form of rescuing is an interminable resistance to closure and completion, in other words, the never-ending act of inheriting. Another way to put this is to say that what remains in Benjamin, the aimless yet attentive wanderer through the streets of Moscow, the thinker of the ruin and of what lives on in fragmented, disfigured form, are certain remains of inheriting. Yet Benjamin's remains remain to be seen, are yet to be received as a heritage, always anew. In Remains to be Seen, the American philosopher Stanley Cavell reflects on Benjamin by asking, quote, why, according to what allegories, make a work that cannot be read through? Perhaps to remind the reader that his and her work must perpetually find its own end. Why make a work that cannot be written to an end? Perhaps to remind the writer of a reason to suffer awakening without end, unquote. Benjamin's texts do not promise closure and mastery, but rather, precisely by suffering awakening without end, as Cavell suggests, they invite, even provoke, future acts of receiving and remain the remains of a heritage that may be as strange as Moscow's. Reading and writing no longer conform to a model of communication or content sharing, as one says in our digital age, but rather to the implications of the insight that, as Benjamin puts it, quote, the now of recognizability bears to the highest degree the stamp of that critical, dangerous moment that lies at the ground of all reading, unquote. This critical, dangerous moment of reading that Benjamin evokes is not to be taken lightly or merely figuratively. Benjamin's singular modes of argumentation and apodictic style have always caused his readers difficulty, and not all his readers of the Moscow Diary, as well as of related texts, have been willing to commit themselves to the singular labor of inheriting that these sentences require. Indeed, the density and originality of his thinking have always worked to turn some readers into non-readers who claim that, almost like Kafka's Man from the Country in the doorkeeper episode Before the Law, they can find no entry into his thought at all. When Benjamin attempted to secure the right to teach, to become a Lehrender in the German university system with his habilitation on the German Baroque morning play, the rejection of which prevented him from embarking on an academic career in Germany, even before such a possibility was negated by the National Socialists' takeover, the referee who had received the task of evaluating the work resisted Benjamin's study without ever actually engaging it. As the neo-Kantian philosopher Hans Cornelius wrote in his official report to the University of Frankfurt on July 7, 1925, a year and a half before Benjamin's Moscow journey, sealing the book's fate, quote, "Dr. Benjamin's work, whose content as it relates to the study of art, I've been asked to assess, is exceedingly difficult to read. A lot of words are used for which the author does not find it necessary to elucidate their sense, but which either have no commonly accepted meaning at all, or which, when they are understood according to their usual meaning, yield no clear sense in the context in which they are employed," unquote. Cornelius continues by relating that he, upon realizing his predicament, asked Benjamin for a concise summary of the Trauerspiel book, a request with which the latter complied. However, Cornelius claims, quote, "Once again, I did not succeed in understanding these elucidations," unquote. He comes to the conclusion that Benjamin, with his, quote, "unintelligible manner of expression, unverständliche Ausdrucksweise," which must, after all, be interpreted as a sign of a substantive lack of clarity, "die doch wohl als ein Zeichen sachlicher Unklarheit gedeutet werden muss," can be no guide or leader to students in our field, kein Führer auf diesem Gebiet sein kann, unquote. Yes, one might say, Benjamin is no Führer. He rather teaches us to stray. Leaving aside Cornelius's refusal to engage with Benjamin's thought on even the most basic level, it is instructive to ask how our perspective on Benjamin's words and sentences would change if the core of Cornelius's criticism, that Benjamin uses words and concepts in a way that is not coextensive with their quotidian usage, or that refunctionalizes them without fully explaining the terms of their refunctionalization, were seen not as an obstacle to be overcome on the way to dreamland of absolute transparency and clarity, but rather were understood precisely as that which makes it possible to inherit Benjamin's provocative work in the first place. That is to say, what if the lack of conformity to an alleged commonplace and agreed upon usage, a conformity which would, after all, leave nothing to interpret, nothing still in need of understanding, were a necessary precondition for the act of innovative, rigorous, open-ended reading and therefore inheriting? Could not the very terms of Cornelius's criticism then be seen as marking the particular rigor, beauty, and afterlife of Benjamin's words and works, that is, the historical drift of the Benjaminian archive as such? Revisiting texts such as the Moscow Diary from the perspective of straying and historical drifting also is an attempt to keep this possibility alive. On the far side of systematicity and closure, the Benjaminian constellation is attuned to the temporally and genealogically mediated view of inheritance. The time of inheritance, like Benjamin's time of history itself, is infinite and open, that is, unfulfilled, as he says, and therefore radically other-directed. Our readings and reinterpretations will be called upon not only to invent new ways of inheriting the dispersed shards, fragments, and ruins of Benjamin's intellectual itinerary, they will also struggle to re-inherit inexhaustible sentences and images in as yet unknown ways that would do justice to the unsettling yet necessary incompleteness of every historically inscribed act of inheriting a refractory legacy. These new forms of inheriting and their attendant acts of reading will wish to show themselves receptive both to the demand, Benjamin's own demand, for slowness, care, and circumspection, and to the irrepressible political urgency that not only suffuses Benjamin's image of Moscow, but also inflects his subsequent image, 2 years later, in the essay on surrealism, of the historical alarm clock that accompanies the movement of straying by ringing, not occasionally, but for 60 seconds every minute.